Good morning, everybody. Bio 241. It's March 22nd, and we're going to cover Chapter 10, Sensory. Some of this is maybe a review because you've done a couple labs in Sensory already. Maybe one, maybe this week, I'm not sure. But we're going to talk about some of the physiology, maybe review a little bit of the anatomy. And we're going to have maybe one and a half lectures on sensory system. So let's get started. Sensory receptors, okay, their job is to transduce various modalities of energy in our environment and convert it into action potentials. And what the heck is an action potential? It has something to do with a nerve. Right? It's something that an axon generates at the axon hillock, and then it transfers that action potential to the end of the axon. And remember, all action potentials are the same, and they're propagated without decrement. And more importantly, what I want to say about an action potential, it is the language of the nervous system. Right? That's how your brain interprets all information, by just looking at action potentials. So that your brain doesn't hear anything, doesn't see anything, doesn't taste anything. It just senses action potentials. So that way of changing taste sensations and visual sensation into action potentials is what we call, that process is what we call transduction. So we're going to look at that a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, I'm looking at the schedule right here. Depends on what we cover today. Okay, so we're scheduled to have the second lecture in sensory today. But since this is the first one, I'm going to see if I can't cover them both today, or maybe just one and a half today. All right, so I did email the new schedule out to everybody. So the syllabus is exactly the same, but the schedule has had to change a little bit. All right, so, and every schedule, of course, always says tentative, so you got to come to class. So that test that's scheduled for March 31st, that's Thursday, that's in a little bit of jeopardy, but we'll see what we can cover. All right, maybe by the end of today or by the end of next time, I can tell if we're going to really have it on the 31st or not. Okay, yeah. Yeah? Okay, I can't quite hear. The reading assignments. Ah, the pre-lecture stuff. Okay, I'll double check on that. Okay, the pre-lecture reading stuff? Yeah, I'll double check on that. But the weekly assignments are all there. Yeah, yeah, okay. Okay. Okay, so a receptor transduces energy that's in one form into another form of energy. All right, so the first form is like, could be visual, could be light, could be photons, or it could be pressure waves. And then a receptor changes that into the form of what? An action potential, which is what your brain can interpret. And so each type of receptor responds to a particular modality. Right, so visual receptors respond to light, and auditory receptors respond to pressure changes in the air. Right, and different modalities are perceived as different, not because of the receptors that are excited, because all receptors change energy that's in the environment into what? Action potentials, right? And all action potentials are the same. So you might be wondering, well, how is it then that I can appreciate photons? How can I appreciate sound waves? How can I appreciate taste and other kinds of sensation if when they're in my brain, they're all just action potentials? And that's because, depending on the receptor, those action potentials go to different parts of the brain. So we have different parts of the cerebral cortex that are responsible for vision and for hearing. And maybe from anatomy, you can remember, what is the visual cortex for vision? The visual cortex is in the occipital lobe, right. So if we stimulate the occipital lobe on anybody artificially, right, by maybe shocking it with electrical information or hitting your head really hard and depolarizing those neurons so that they produce action potentials, what you're going to experience, right, is going to be some kind of a visual sensation, right? You might see stars or whatever, right? So different modalities perceived as different because of the areas of the central nervous system that get stimulated. And auditory sensations are perceived by the temporal lobe. So we'll probably look at some of these different lobes in here. Okay, so sensory receptors could be simple dendritic endings that we see maybe around this hair follicle right here. And when you move that hair follicle, it changes the membrane of this receptor right here, and it depolarizes and then sends signals to the brain, action potentials to the brain. And temperature receptors are just simple nerve endings as well. And other kinds of receptors are more complicated. They have specialized nerve endings that depolarize and then excite this dendritic process. And then if that graded potential is at threshold when it reaches the axon, then an action potential will go to the brain. All right, so some of these specialized nerve endings, like this Pacinian corpuscle you see is very deep, so this is for deep pressure. Some, like this Meissner's corpuscle right here, is for very light pressure on the surface of the skin. And as a matter of fact, some people can read using these Meissner's corpuscles, right, by doing what? Just by feeling little dimples on a piece of paper, which we call Braille. Okay, and so then you just have to learn how to read those different sequences of dimples or depressions or little ridges on a piece of paper. All right, so another way we can talk about sensory receptors, if they are sensitive to chemicals that are in the environment or chemicals inside your body, we call those chemoreceptors. Really good examples would be there are receptors in the pancreas that can sense glucose in your blood, right, because the pancreas is involved with releasing insulin. There are places in the brain that can sense hydrogen ion concentration or pH, and so those are all chemoreceptors. Photoreceptors transduce light into action potentials. And where do you have receptors for that? Yeah, in your eye, right? Those are photoreceptors. Thermal receptors respond to temperature changes in your body, and you have those all over the place. You have some that are centrally located in the hypothalamus, but you also have those located all over your skin so that you can feel temperature. Mechanoreceptors respond to mechanical changes in your environment and maybe even inside your body. So when they bend or deform, then they can increase the rate of action potentials or decrease the rate of action potentials going to some part of the brain which is responsible for coordinating different motions in your body, maintaining balance. Nociceptors respond to intense stimuli that are going to be damaging to your body. So these are sort of like pain receptors, but they can be triggered by high levels of chemicals or temperature or excessive deformation of different tissues in your body. Right? So these are really important to help protect your tissues. And proprioceptors, this is an interesting kind. These respond to muscle position and muscle tension and joint position. And so these proprioceptors signal the position of various body parts in your body and what kind of tension muscle is producing. So you have proprioceptors all over the body. So some of those receptors you have all over the body, and some of these receptors you only have in one or two locations. And so sometimes we break down senses into either general or special senses. And you should be able to recognize each one of these different receptors and tell me if it's a special or a general sense. So a general sense is a sense that you have all over your body. And a good example of that would be temperature. Because if I took an ice cube and I put it on your earlobe, you could tell it was cold. Or your belly button, you could tell it's cold. Or the back of your neck. So you have temperature receptors all over your body. So we call that a general sense. And so pain is also a general sense, right? So if I took a pin and I poked your fingertip, you could tell, or your earlobe or kneecap or belly button, you could tell that painful stimulus as well. A special sense, on the other hand, right, is from a receptor that you have only in one or two locations, and usually that receptor is a very complicated receptor organ. For instance, like your eyes. You only have two eyes, and if I took a flashlight and I turn that flashlight on just your belly button, could you see it? Absolutely not. Your kneecap, could you see it? Absolutely not. Right? So only when those photons reach your eyes do you have that sense of seeing something. So you have five special senses. Okay? You have vision. So I have sight down here. And hearing, because again, if I took like a little earbud that was playing some music and put it in your belly button, could you hear it? No, you need it in your ears. So hearing is a special sense. Only two specialized and very small locations in your body for hearing. Equilibrium, we're going to talk about that today, that allows you to maintain balance in two different ways. There's static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. Those are located in the petrous region of your temporal bone. They're part of your inner ear. So you don't have that sense of equilibrium anywhere else in your body, but it's in your inner ear. And two other special senses. There are two other special senses. Anybody have a guess what they are? I don't have them on this list right here. Taste. We call that the gustatory sensation, taste. And again, if there was some sugar on the table and you palpated it with your fingertips, could you taste it? Or if you had antennae, only if you're an insect could you taste it. But for you, what would you have to do? You'd have to take those chemicals, put it in your mouth, and stimulate the taste buds on your tongue, right? So that's the gustatory sense. So you only have taste in your mouth, nowhere else on your body. So is that a general or special sense? That's special, okay? And then the last one is olfaction, which is the sense of smell. Again, you can't smell with your fingertips or your elbow or any other place on your body, only with nerve endings that are in your nasal cavity, the superior part of your nasal cavity, as a matter of fact. So those are the five senses: hearing, sight, gustation, olfaction, and then two senses for equilibrium, static and kinetic equilibrium, that we're going to talk about. Okay. We can classify receptors one of two kinds, either tonic receptors or phasic receptors. Tonic receptors respond at a constant rate of action potential. So here we see a recording of action potentials, and notice that the period between these action potentials is exactly the same. So that if we put on a stimulus, if we apply a stimulus and keep the amplitude of the stimulus constant for a long period of time, these receptors will generate action potentials at the exact same frequency, and these will reach the brain at the exact same frequency until the stimulus is withdrawn. Nothing will change. And what about when these action potentials reach the brain? What about the amplitude of this action potential reaching the brain? It's going to be exactly the same. The duration of an action potential won't change as well. So that's what we call a tonic receptor. Tonic receptors do not adapt to stimuli, so the kinds of things that are important that your body should not adapt to or become less sensitive to would be like pain types of stimulus, painful kinds of stimulus, because if your pain is representing damaging stimulus to your body. So if you have a damaging stimulus to your body, you should be aware of that. So what can you do then? You can, take some kind of action to withdraw your body from that damaging stimulus, right? And so I'm sure we all have gone to the dentist and they numbed a couple nerves or poisoned a couple nerves in your mouth, and as those nerves are not able to carry action potentials and you don't have a sense of pain in your mouth. And what does a dentist always tell you to do? Don't eat anything, right? While those pain nerve endings, right, are not functional, because as you're eating one of your favorite sandwiches, what else could you be doing and not even know it? You could be chewing up your tongue or your cheek or something, right? And of course you don't want to do that. All right, so tonic receptors respond typically to pain or high temperature, things like that. Phasic receptors, on the other hand, change the way that they stimulate a sensory neuron. Initially, it's very sensitive to a stimulus, so we see a high rate of action potential when the stimulus is applied. And if we keep the stimulus amplitude the same over the same period of time, that receptor adapts, right? And then it doesn't depolarize the sensory neuron quite as much, and so the frequency of action potentials actually diminishes. And what did we call that? How does the brain interpret intensity? I think we looked at that a couple months ago. We call that frequency coding, right? Because the amplitude of every action potential is exactly the same. The way that your brain understands intensity is by the frequency of action potentials, not the amplitude or the duration of an action potential. All right, so even though the stimulus is exactly the same, a phasic receptor will decrease the way that it stimulates a neuron, so that a neuron then decreases the rate of action potentials that it's sending to the brain, and we call that adaptation. So some kinds of senses that work that way are smell. For instance, when you walk into a library, if I were to walk you around campus blindfolded and we walked into the library, or pretty much any library in the country, right, you could probably tell it was a library because it has a characteristic smell of all the books that are inside of a library, right? But after you're in the library for about 5 or 10 minutes, that sensation completely disappears, right? And you couldn't really tell what building you're in. And touch is another good example of that. So when you first put on shoes in the morning or clothes or whatever, you can feel that all over your body, but of course it's not a very important stimulus, right? So that adapts very, very quickly. So smell and touch are a couple examples of phasic receptors. There's a lot of specific nerve energies that has to do with sensation. And it just says that stimulation of sensory fibers evokes only the sensation of that particular modality because it goes to that part of the brain. Action potentials only go to that part of the brain and it's recognized as that particular modality. And there is something that's called adequate stimulus. This is the normal stimulus that a receptor will respond to. So what's the adequate stimulus for a photoreceptor? Would be light or photons, okay? And, okay, so that is an adequate stimulus, but some of those receptors could be stimulated by other kinds of energy or modalities of energy. Like if someone punches you in the eye, you're going to see visual effects. Just the mechanical deformation of those photoreceptors in your eye will stimulate action potentials in the optic nerve and you'll have some kind of visual experience, but that's not an adequate stimulus, right? Or maybe you've been hit by a pitch or somebody kicked a soccer ball in your face or something like that and you've seen some stars if it hit your eye. Okay, the adequate stimulus just means that it's the least amount of energy that is required to activate a receptor. It doesn't say that that a receptor won't respond to other kinds of stimuli, but an adequate stimulus is the kind of stimulus that that receptor is most sensitive to. All right, so light would be for a photoreceptor. A particular chemical for a chemoreceptor would be an adequate stimulus, but they can be stimulated by high intensity energy of other forms. Okay. All right, so we talked about these different kinds of receptors here already, right? Mechanoreceptors, pain, photoreceptors, chemoreceptors. So a receptor cell is responsible for producing generator potentials. All right, so they are equivalents of EPSPs, and that's what? Excitatory postsynaptic potential, and these are graded potentials, so they vary in amplitude, they vary in duration, right? And these are produced in response to an adequate stimulus in various kinds of receptors. So here we see, here is a generator potential that's being developed in a nerve dendrite, but how would we characterize this generator potential number one right here? It is, here's the threshold, it is below threshold, so this is a sub-threshold stimulus, right? And number two is a sub-threshold stimulus. And then as the intensity of that energy increases, right, then the amplitude of the graded potential increases until we see that it actually creates an action potential along that initial segment or the axon hillock of that sensory neuron. And this is what we call a threshold stimulus, right? So you're pretty familiar with that. And so this stimulus right here, what would be a good molecular way that you could describe what's happening right here with this number three or number two or number one generator potential? What's happening to cause this kind of generator potential in the membrane of this neuron? It's a stimulus, yeah, and so, but molecularly, what's happening? What's a good way to think of a stimulus? A stimulating or a stimulus to an axon is typically what? What's going to cause depolarization? Okay. Right, because, yeah, when a sodium channel opens, for instance, okay, one way or another, that could be producing this stimulus right here. Okay, so generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. All right, after a threshold is reached, that action potential frequency then is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential. All right, so if the generator potential is, let's go back to the previous slide, if the generator potential is very high and lasts a long time, if it lasts even into this relative refractory period, it could still be at threshold, and another action potential can ensue very rapidly after the first if the generator potential amplitude is real high. But if it's just a threshold generator potential, notice that it dies away by the time this relative refractory period happens, and it cannot stimulate another action potential at all. Right? So the frequency of action potentials is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potentials. Right? But in phasic receptors, the generator potential adapts very quickly to a constant stimulus and then diminishes in amplitude. Okay, so here is another slide that just shows a sub-threshold stimulus, barely threshold stimulus. So the sub-threshold stimulus does not produce any action potentials. And we can see that the generator potential is what? Directly related to the stimulus intensity. So this first case, the stimulus intensity is very low. The next case, it's a little bit higher. The third case, it's even higher still. And the generator potential amplitude increases as the amplitude of the stimulus increases. And because this threshold stimulus can't overcome the relative refractory period, it takes a long time for another action potential to become developed. All right, but if the generator potential amplitude is real high, it can overcome that relative refractory period, and an action potential will ensue very rapidly after the first and then after the other. So we can see that frequency coding is a way of telling the central nervous system what the amplitude of the stimulus is, right, just by frequency coding. All right, so now for the rest of the chapter, we're just going to look at special senses. What are those special senses again? You've got olfaction, gustation, vision, and two senses for equilibrium, static and kinetic equilibrium. So we're going to talk about some of those. Oh, I think maybe I should turn some of these lights down a little bit. I just looked up at the screen. Hopefully that's a little bit better. All right, so special senses. So let's maybe just talk about gustation and olfaction first. Okay? These receptors are what we call exteroreceptors. That's another way of talking about receptors because they respond to chemicals that are not inside your body, but where? Outside, in the environment, right? So it's a way of communicating with the environment. Interoceptors respond to chemicals inside your body. Like what might be a good kind of chemoreceptor inside your body? What would be important to measure inside your body? pH, hydrogen ion concentration. Okay, maybe carbon dioxide, right? Because if carbon dioxide goes up, maybe you want to adjust your respiratory rate or your ventilatory rate, increase to breathing. Glucose concentration, right? Okay, those would be examples of interoceptors. All right, but let's talk about gustation. Here we have a taste bud, and notice these are cells within a taste bud. A taste bud might have maybe 100 cells, so it's a very small organ, and with your naked eye, can you see these cells right here? No. What would you need to see these cells? A microscope. So a taste bud actually is a microscopic structure. It's not something that you can see. But you're probably maybe just a little bit confused because if you look in a mirror and stick your tongue out, you do see things on the surface of your tongue. Okay, but now what are those things that you can actually see? I want you to be aware of that distinction. What those little things are papillae, right? Just lingual papillae. And lining all of those little projections that makes the surface of your tongue kind of like a velvety surface, right, are hundreds or thousands of these taste buds. So it's not the papillae that give you the sense of gustation. It's all of these taste buds that are on the inside of them. So here's the surface of the tongue. Here is a little taste pore. And various kinds of compounds have to dissolve in saliva and enter this taste bud via this taste pore and bind to receptors on these things that almost look like cilia that poke off of these taste cells right here. So a taste cell is the receptor cell, and the receptors for those molecules that you can taste are on the taste hairs right here. So they're not really hairs, but they're just little ciliary projections. And there are basically five fundamental taste sensations. So we see sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and then there is one that gives you a sense of fulfillment when you eat something and is due to various amino acids that are in the food that you eat, and we commonly call that umami, right? And that's derived from a Japanese word which means deliciousness or fulfillment, right? So these taste receptor cells right here make the taste bud, and when these cells change their electrical property, then that will depolarize this neuron right here, which then goes to the brain. Okay, so these taste cells, which will depolarize or hyperpolarize, change their electrical activity, don't send signals to the brain, but will generate what generator potentials in this sensory neuron right here. Okay, so let's look at some of these tastes. Salty. All right, so what is, anybody know what the chemical compound of what table salt is? What's table salt? It's just sodium chloride, right? NaCl. And when you put that in your mouth, it dissolves very easily into saliva, enters the taste pore. So now you have a high concentration of sodium in your mouth. And it just so happens, here's that taste receptor cell, and here's the cilia sticking off, the little hair sticking off of it. And here is a sodium channel that's open all the time. So when sodium concentration increases in your mouth, sodium diffuses into the cell, but what does that do to the cell? That depolarizes the cell, right? So that depolarizes the cell, and that generator, or that, actually it's a graded potential, then travels down through the cell, and down by the basal end of that receptor cell, there are voltage-gated calcium channels. And calcium, remember, is high outside the cells. Calcium enters, and then it causes the fusion and release of these neurotransmitters, which then cause large graded potentials or generator potentials in the sensory neuron. And when these large graded potentials reach the axon hillock, that sends an that develops an action potential, which is then sent to the brain, to the gustatory region of the brain. And since this cell is automatically wired to the sense of salt in the cerebral cortex of the brain, then you perceive the sense of saltiness in your mouth, right? So that's just due to that nice sodium channel right there. So these cells can put different kinds of proteins in the cell membrane, because remember the fluid mosaic model of a membrane, all kinds of different proteins can be inserted into the cell membrane, and for the sense of salt, these taste cells have sodium channels that are open all the time. The sense of sour is due to acids that you ingest, like vinegar, acetic acid. Vinegar and acetic acid are the same, or lemon juice or whatever, right? And so as the hydrogen ion concentration increases in your mouth, and of course hydrogen ion dissolves in saliva very easily, there is a proton channel right here that is open all the time. So as hydrogen ion increases, right, then what happens to this taste receptor cell? Because hydrogen ion is a cation, it depolarizes the cell. And through the same mechanism, there are calcium voltage-gated channels in the basal region of the cell. As calcium enters the cell, then these vesicles of neurotransmitter fuse and exocytose neurotransmitter on the sensory neuron, and then you have the sensation of sour inside your mouth as a result. All right, so that sour is due to acid that you're eating. Okay, so these are two of the basic senses, but we have a couple more. Okay, and these last three do not involve directly ion channels. These work through G-protein coupled receptors. All right, so these receptors have to have the same basic kind of shape or complementary shape to the molecule that you will be sensing. Like sweet would be due to the shape of a sugar molecule, right? Like glucose or something like that. So sugar will bind to this receptor right here. It's a G-protein coupled receptor. And what does a G-protein coupled receptor always do? It produces a second messenger. So the first messenger will be a sugar that's outside. The second messenger, could you give me an example of a potential second messenger? Cyclic AMP, right? Could be one. And so here's a second messenger then that diffuses through the cell and it bumps into some potassium channels that are normally open. All right, when these potassium channels are normally open, what's the state of the cell right here? Is it normally depolarized or is it hyperpolarized? If potassium can leave, right, it hyperpolarizes the cell. And what does that do to the cell? Is that an excitatory or inhibitory event? When it's hyperpolarized, that is inhibitory on the cell. So when these potassium channels close, right, that inhibits that hyperpolarization. So if you stop hyperpolarization, what happens as a result? Depolarization, right? So you stop hyperpolarization, that depolarizes the cell, and that now is excitatory as a result of sugar binding to this G protein. Since it's a depolarizing event, then that triggers the release of neurotransmitter, which then produces generator potentials right here in proportion to the amount of receptors that are bound to sugar or bound to amino acids. So there are different cells for sugars and amino acids. They have different kinds of receptors, right? And it goes to different parts of the brain so that you sense sweetness or fulfillment when you eat something. Bitter has a different kind of receptor, works through a little bit different mechanism, but it still starts off with a G protein coupled receptor. Right, so in this particular case, a good example of a bitter tasting compound would be quinine. Where could you buy quinine in the grocery store if you wanted to experience a bitter sensation? Okay, like tonic water has quinines in it. So you could go on your way home, buy some tonic water that you can make other kinds of drinks with, right? But I'm not going to tell you what kinds of drinks, but you can mix it with other things or just drink it straight up maybe, or with ice cubes or something. And so quinine is going to bind to this G protein coupled receptor, and that's going to increase the concentration of a second messenger inside the cell. Now this second messenger is not going to work on a potassium channel, but it's going to work on a calcium channel. And it's not on the cell membrane, but it's going to be on smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Because what are the two functions of smooth endoplasmic reticulum that you're aware of? Would be for lipid synthesis, number one, but number two, it's also typically used in some cells as a reservoir of calcium. Okay, so there are calcium pumps on this smooth endoplasmic reticulum that are continuously pumping calcium from the cytosol inside the, into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum right here, maintaining low calcium concentration inside the cell. All right, but when the second messenger binds to these proteins, that opens up calcium channels, that floods the cytosol with calcium, and then that causes release of neurotransmitter or exocytosis of neurotransmitter, causing large generative potentials on this sensory neuron. And you then have the sense of bitter because these neurons carry action potentials to that part of the brain that is specifically designed, when it receives action potentials, to give you the sensation of bitter. All right, so things that you eat are composed of these various five senses, and then you can tell what the particular compound is. So what's a nice way of thinking about how these different modalities can contribute their individual essence to what you understand a food to be? What is one food that you can tell has all these different components? And if you taste all those different components, you know exactly what it is right away. Does anybody have a food or a drink in mind? How about a margarita? When you drink a margarita, and there's salt on the rim of the glass, right? Don't get one without salt, right? You drink a margarita with salt, what do you taste? Do you taste saltiness? Of course. What about sweetness? Absolutely. What about bitter? Yeah, what about sour? All those are in the right particular combination, and when that combination is met, then that part of the brain says, oh, you're drinking a margarita, and you're not ready to take a test, right? You're on a vacation mode. Okay, so these sensations are blended in your brain, and you can tell what the various foods or drinks that you're consuming are. Okay, so these are some nice exam figures that you should know. What do we call that process where we have a first messenger like quinine and that produces a second messenger inside the cell? How do we talk about this process right here? What is that process called? Because here's a signaling molecule, okay, and that causes a change in physiology of this cell right here. We call that signal transduction, right? Signal transduction. So here is a receptor, and it's transducing this information, which is a chemical compound outside the cell, to what? Chemical information inside the cell. So that's signal transduction. So any kind of receptor is going to do that. It's going to transduce the signal. And in this particular case, that signal is going to go from quinine to what? Release of neurotransmitter. And then it's furthermore converted into what kind of signals in this neuron right here? Into action potentials, right? So that's just a way of converting some energy modality into another modality, like the concentration of quinine into a frequency of action potentials reaching the brain. Okay, olfaction. Is that a special or general sense? That's special. You can only smell with your nose because here's the nasal cavity, and even superior to the superior nasal conchae right here, we have some neurons that are actually dangling down outside of your body. And this is the only place I know of where we have actual neurons that are hanging outside your body. And as a result, that's a pretty rough environment. Anything that you get inside your nasal cavity now has access to these neurons right here. So that's a really rough environment. So these neurons have adapted to where they can be replaced about every 2 weeks, because you can lose these neurons, and as long as you didn't destroy the stem cells that are in the epithelium that lines the nasal cavity, they can be regenerated. Right, so stem cells actually will reproduce these neurons right here. And let's see, do you know neurons by shape? I think you do. When you look at the shape of this neuron, or this neuron right here, or this one right, oh, here's a good one right here. What is the shape of this neuron? How about multipolar? Is that multipolar? What about unipolar? No, this looks like a bipolar neuron. And as a matter of fact, the only place where we really see bipolar neurons is in the apparatus for special senses. Right, so here we see it right in the olfactory system. So here are bipolar neurons, and it has some hairs sticking down into your nasal cavity, and these are cilia. And these cilia have various receptors on them. And when the odorant molecule binds to receptor, then that will cause depolarization of this bipolar neuron, which then has an axon going through the cribriform plate, through these olfactory foramina, into the olfactory bulb, right below the frontal lobe. And then there's a synapse right here on these olfactory neurons, which then take olfactory action potentials to the olfactory part of the brain. All right, and these areas right here are what we call glomeruli, which are inside the olfactory bulb. Okay, so in this epithelium right here, there are receptor cells, there are support cells that try to adjust the environment of these bipolar cells so that it's not so rough. Because remember, what kind of conditions are in your nasal cavity? Basically, whatever is in the atmosphere, right? So it could contain harmful chemicals, like if you're in a chemistry lab, right? There could be bromine in there, or acid, or whatever. Okay, if you're in Japan, what could it contain? Like radioactive substances, right? Things like that, which are going to destroy these cells. And then if they do get destroyed, then these basal cells, right, are stem cells that can rebuild these bipolar neurons. So that's really interesting. I find that pretty interesting. So the support cells are important for detoxification. The stem cells are important for regeneration of these bipolar cells right here. Now, if this epithelium is destroyed to such an extent that the stem cells are destroyed, then what happens to your sense of smell? It will never recover, right? So that can happen to people in industry as well. Okay, so, why did I find that interesting? Because what do you know about regeneration of nerves, especially, say, in the central nervous system? They can, like in the spinal cord, because those oligodendrocytes prevent that from happening. So that doesn't necessarily have to be. Wouldn't it be interesting if someone could figure out a way to take these stem cells, and make neurons so that they could be transplanted into somebody's spinal cord to overcome that injury. Because what are those stem cells programmed to do? Regenerate damaged nervous tissue. So that's pretty interesting. I'm sure in the future somebody will figure out how to do that. But then what might you be concerned with? You might be smelling with your back. Okay, I'm just kind of kidding. Okay, maybe not, because your spinal cord is deep inside your body. But it's not the receptors, the sense of smell is not the receptors, it's what? It's the area of your brain that is getting action potentials, right? So even if you have olfactory receptors, say in your spinal cord, if those action potentials don't go to your olfactory center in your brain, then of course you can't smell anything, right? So it's the area of the brain that depolarizes due to action potentials, not the receptor or receptor cells. Okay, so odor molecules have to bind to those receptors, and there are G protein coupled receptors, right? So they work through first messengers, second messengers, and the kinds of receptor proteins in the nose is huge. There's thousands. We don't really even know. Maybe there's 10,000 different primary sense receptors, and so I'm not going to break it down like we did for taste. Okay, just know that it's a huge family, and it's very complicated. Okay, let's move on to ears and hearing, but let's go to this slide first just to review some of your anatomy of the ear. Okay, so we have three senses for the ear. All right, so we've talked about taste and smell. So here is the ear. So the ear can be broken down into external ear, which includes the pinna right here. So here's the helix that helps focus sound energy into the external auditory meatus. Now, what bone is this right here? Do you remember that? What bone has the external auditory meatus? Go get your anatomy books out, then kind of look that up again. That's a temporal bone. Okay, and right at the end of the external auditory meatus, there is a membrane right here that we call the tympanic membrane. And sound is a pressure wave that varies above and below atmospheric pressure. And when it reaches this tympanic membrane, it's going to vibrate back and forth. And when it vibrates back and forth, that sends that sound energy into the middle ear. The middle ear is between the tympanic membrane and another tiny membrane that's right at the entrance to the inner ear. And we call this a window, and it has a particular shape. Can you see what shape that is? It's oval. It's not a square. It's not round. Right, so the foot of the stapes, that auditory ossicle right here, is oval, so that is the oval window. That's how sound pressure energy enters the inner ear right here. So the middle ear has these three auditory ossicles, and the incus malleus and stapes, and the stapes is right here. Maybe you need to go back and review that. And in order for the tympanic membrane to vibrate back and forth, the middle ear right here has to be exactly at atmospheric pressure. If it's above or below, if it's above atmospheric pressure, it's going to push the tympanic membrane out all the way, and then it can't vibrate because it's stuck, right? Or if the atmospheric pressure in this middle compartment is real low, tympanic membrane is going to be pushed all the way in, and again, it can't vibrate. So since this middle compartment is deep inside your body, it has to equilibrate with atmospheric pressure, and there's a way that it can via your throat. So it equilibrates with pressure inside your throat, which is atmospheric pressure, via what? This little tube right here, which is called the Eustachian tube or the auditory tube. But the best name for this is what? The pharyngotympanic tube. Because what's your pharynx? When you have a pharyngitis, what do you have? You have a sore throat, right? So the pharynx is your throat. So here's a tube that goes from your pharynx right to the middle ear so that this tympanic membrane can vibrate back and forth. But when you have a cold, what happens? You have inflammation. This pharyngotympanic tube occludes, and now you can't equilibrate. Or if the cold is so severe, this might actually fill up with fluid, which means then that these bones can't vibrate back and forth. And so you have now a loss of hearing because you don't have conduction of the sound wave through the middle ear to the inner ear right here. Okay, so be familiar. And as a matter of fact, you know, maybe you should review. There's a couple little muscles in here that help dampen the vibration of these bones when you're in a really noisy environment, like the stapedius is in here and some other muscles. Maybe you need to go back and look at some of those things. All right, so now we have sound energy entering the inner ear right here. And the inner ear has a bony labyrinth, and then we have some membranes and receptor cells for the senses that we're interested in inside of the inner ear. And this thing that looks like a snail is what we call the cochlea, right? That's the bony labyrinth. This is the organ for hearing. And then we have the vestibule right here, and then we have semicircular canals. These are bony labyrinths for the other two sensations of equilibrium. Okay, so notice that the size of the tympanic membrane is large compared to the size of the oval window. And that's important because it's very difficult for sound to go from air into water. I don't know if anybody has ever been in a swimming pool and maybe you had a conversation with somebody with your head above water, maybe try this over the weekend, and continue that conversation with your head underwater. And guess what? As soon as your head goes underwater, you can hardly hear the person that's talking to you because sound energy has difficulty entering water. You have water inside the inner ear, so the amplitude of that sound wave has to increase. And so that's the job of the difference in the size and the ratios of the tympanic membrane and the oval window right here, and the arrangement of this lever system produced by these auditory ossicles to make sure that sound energy can actually enter the watery environment in the inner ear right here. So it's a way of amplifying the signal, but this actually an impedance matching device that allows sound energy to enter the inner ear right here. So make sure you know these different components of the ear. So now let's go back and start talking about some of these things. So have you seen this structure before? Yeah. Absolutely, right? That's part of the inner ear. Okay, and so the vestibular apparatus sometimes includes the description of it includes the vestibule right here as well as the semicircular canals. And these areas right here give you a sense of equilibrium, right? And there are two of them, the two senses of equilibrium. One is what we call static equilibrium, and that's good for linear acceleration. And so let's talk about acceleration a little bit. What the heck does acceleration mean? So you know what speed is. Speed and velocity are really the same thing. How could you tell how fast you're going in your car? What would you look at? Your speedometer. And what's the dimensions of that dial right there? What are you looking at when you read that? Like distance per time, right? Miles per hour. That is a velocity. Acceleration, on the other hand, is a change in velocity. Okay, so it's not what velocity you're at, but how your velocity is changing. That's what acceleration. And linear acceleration just means what, forwards and backwards, just a motion going forwards and backwards. And you actually have two ways to measure acceleration in your ear, forwards and backwards, is and up and down as well. Okay, those are two ways that you can measure a change in velocity. Okay, this and that happens in the vestibule due to some organs that are in the utricle and saccule right here. These semicircular canals give you another sense of equilibrium. These are circular because the fluid in these compartments right here can actually spin around, can actually make a nice circular motion, almost like a vortex in here, or a whirlpool, right? Fluid can flow around in a circle. So these give us a sense of what we call kinetic equilibrium or angular acceleration. All right, so the vestibule is for linear acceleration. The semicircular canals are for angular acceleration. What's a common way of saying angular acceleration? It's a change in rate of how you're spinning, okay? And since you have three, you can tell a change in rate that you're spinning which way? From right to left, head over heels, okay, and also side to side. So all three of the basic planes, right, will tell you how you're spinning in three-dimensional space. And as your brain adds up or integrates information from these three different semicircular canals, you can tell exactly which way you're spinning in space. Okay. And it's going to be oriented to gravity. So these are all in the inner ear. And we call these otolith organs, because an otolith is a little crystal of calcium carbonate. So it's almost like a tiny, tiny little bone, but bone, remember, is living tissue. It has osteocytes in it. Otoliths right here are just pure crystals. It's not really a living tissue. It's more like a grain of salt, except it's made out of calcium carbonate. Okay, so inside that bony labyrinth, okay, we have a membranous labyrinth, okay, and it's filled with endolymph. All right, so we're going to look at that in a little bit. So here is the utricle and saccule, and I think we're going to talk about linear acceleration first. Okay, here are some cells that have cilia. Sometimes we call these stereocilia. And so we're interested in both linear and angular acceleration. It has these cells that have these stereocilia on them, and that reminded somebody of hair when they first looked at these cells. So guess what they call these cells right here and right here? These are hair cells. So the stereocilia bump into each other, and they're even connected to a stereocilium right here, which is special. You see it has a special little shape. It's called a kinocilium. And this kinocilium has different kinds of membrane channels in it that either open or close depending on how it's bent. So it's a mechanical receptor. It's a mechanoreceptor. Right? If the kinocilium bends toward the stereocilia, then that closes channels and that inhibits this cell right here, and we can see the frequency of action potentials decreases. If the stereocilia bump into the kinocilium and bend it over the other way, to the left in this particular case, away from the stereocilia, it opens channels and that causes more depolarization, so that causes a higher frequency of action potentials. So these hair cells can either increase or decrease the rate of action potentials reaching the brain, and that's going to give you a sense of equilibrium, which is pretty interesting that hair cells can do that. Okay, so how does this actually happen? Okay, for the utricle and saccule, okay, they are contained in the maculae. All right, there are two kinds of maculae. There's a utricle and saccule, and there are hair cells. So here are some hair cells. The stereocilia poke up into a little gelatinous mass right here inside your ear. And on top of that gelatinous mass are all of these little weights that are made out of calcium carbonate that we call otoliths, right? And what does oto mean? Does that root of that word oto, what does that have to do with? The sense of hearing, right? So for instance, anytime you hear oto, you should think of hearing. And sometimes a healthcare provider wants to look inside your ear to see if you have an infection of the middle ear, right? We call that otitis media. Media is the middle ear, and otitis is what? Inflammation of oto, the ear. And what would they use? What's the instrument that somebody would use to look inside your ear? It's an otoscope, right? So anytime you hear that term oto, automatically think of ear. Okay, and so here are the weights. The weights will press down on just this gelatinous mass. And if your head is straight up, okay, it's not going to bend the stereocilia right here. And so that's going to have one rate of action potentials reaching the brain. But as soon as you tilt your head forward, gravity acts as acceleration, and it's going to pull these otoliths inferiorly, and it's going to bend these stereocilia. And so you're going to know that your head has changed position relative to gravity. But even if your head is straight like that, if you accelerate in a car, you'll get a sense of acceleration as well as you step on the gas pedal, because these stereocilia will bend back and forth. Okay? All right, so that's for static equilibrium. Not a sense of spinning, but just a change in linear acceleration. All right, the semicircular canals will tell you what the change of what angular acceleration is, because this fluid can flow around through these semicircular canals. Now here is the utricle and saccule, that's for linear acceleration. Here are the organs for angular acceleration, and that organ is what we call the crista ampullaris. Right, so there's a crista ampullaris, and where does this term ampullaris come from? To help maybe you appreciate and help remember the difference right here. Ampullaris comes from, well, the word in English is amplitude, not amplitude, but ampule. What's a little ampule? Sometimes it's a little vial that maybe a medication comes in. It's a little glass vial, right? And you break it open, you snap the top off, and then you can aspirate the contents into a syringe or something. So an ampule is just a tiny, tiny little compartment that is holding something, right? And so here is an ampule, and it contains the crista ampullaris. And there are three for the three different ways that you can spin in space. All right, so let's look in particular at the crista ampullaris. It's a little bit different, right? There's a little bit of a bulge right here. And in this bulge, so here we have the epithelium with support cells. Again, you have hair cells. And the hair cells have cilia that poke up into a little gelatinous mass right here that we call the cupula. And you have endolymph surrounding the cupula. And when you're stationary, that fluid, okay, is not moving. So it's not going to bend the cupula one way or the other. And if the cupula is not bending, neither are these stereocilia. Right? But that fluid, the endolymph inside the semicircular canal, has momentum. Okay? What the heck is momentum? Any kind of physical substance exhibits the property of momentum. And what does momentum mean? Does it mean anything to anybody? Okay, it just means that if there is a mass, if it is moving, it's going to have a tendency to stay in motion. All right, or if there's a mass and it's not moving, it's going to have a tendency to stay still, all right, to not move. All right, so if something's moving, it wants to stay moving. If it's not moving, it wants to stay still. That's what momentum means, right? So, and that's a property of all matter, including that endolymph that's inside the ear. So here I have a coffee mug. I think I have I've got it closed so the coffee can't run out. So what's the property of this mug and all this coffee inside here? It has momentum, right? Which means that if it's stationary, it doesn't want to move. If it is in motion, it wants to continue moving. All right, so maybe you're going to have a bunch of people over for, what's the next holiday coming over? Easter's, right? Maybe you're going to get together with family, celebrate Easter a little bit, okay? And you set the table. And so here you have a turkey and candles and wine glasses and wine and champagne and stuff like that. And here is the tablecloth, right? And you're going to now demonstrate to everybody in your family that you know what momentum is. And you're going to take that tablecloth and you're going to rip it out from underneath all those glasses and everything, and they're not going to tip over, because what do all those glasses want to do? They just want to stay there while you try to move them, right? So you could go like that, right? And everybody's going to go, oh, wow, okay? You're taking physiology class or physics class or something, right? So as you start to turn your head, what about all that endolymph in those semicircular canals? As you're turning, right, the crista ampullaris is going to start moving with you because it's attached to your body, but what about the endolymph? It's going to stay stationary, so the stationary endolymph is going to press up against this cupula right here, right, as it flows over it, and you're going to have a sense of starting to spin as you start to spin. Okay? So as you start to spin, you get that sense of spinning. So now you've been spinning for a long period of time, around and around and around. And I know you've all done this, maybe even last night. Okay? What happens to that fluid inside your ear as you're spinning for a long period of time? Okay? So you start out slow and you keep spinning. What happens to that fluid? It catches up to your body and starts to move within your body. Right? So now it's moving, it's spinning, and then all of a sudden you stop. And the cupula stops. But what about that fluid inside your ear? What is it going to do? All right, so you got that fluid moving inside your ear, and then all of a sudden you're going to stop really fast. What happens to the fluid? It continues moving. So now it bends the cupula back the other way, and what do you have? You have this really weird sensation of spinning the opposite direction, but are you spinning? You're not spinning, but the endolymph is spinning inside your ear, so you get that misimpression that you're really spinning as a result of that, right? So that is due to what? The angular deceleration the other way. So that's due to the semicircular canals. and these hair cells moving back the other direction. Due to, oh, it's not momentum, it's inertia, sorry. Okay, inertia is the property. Momentum is something that comes out of inertia. Inertia is the property that keeps something stationary if it's not moving, or keeps it moving in the same direction, the same speed, unless there's a force to oppose it. All right, on the slide over here on the right, we have the three senses of the ear. You know, if it's not in Blackboard, I'll check. Okay, and I'll put it up there. Okay, but you should be familiar with this, and probably you should be able to write this out. I don't want to take time to write it on the board, so I just give you a slide right here. What are the three senses involved with your ear? You've got hearing, oh, which we didn't talk about yet. Okay, static equilibrium and kinetic equilibrium. All right, so we're going to come back to this slide sometime real soon. But let's just kind of, let's forget this slide. Let's talk about hearing. Okay, so I'll put it in Blackboard, or we'll talk about it a little bit later today. All right, so we talked about what? Static equilibrium, which is linear acceleration, and kinetic equilibrium, which is what? Angular acceleration. These help maintain balance for us. Okay, the third sense is what? Hearing. We're not as far along as I thought. So hearing, right, these are just sound waves. And a sound wave is a mechanical wave, right? It's a variation in pressure that's traveling through space. And there's different ways that we characterize a wave. We characterize it by the frequency, right? As the frequency increases, the pitch increases, so it sounds like a higher frequency. As the frequency decreases, it sounds what, like a lower frequency? And it's characterized by the number of cycles that it goes from a maximum, all right, back to that maximum again. So a wave is a maximum, goes through zero, goes to a minimum, comes back to a maximum again. That's a wave. Depending on how many times it happens in 1 second, we call that the frequency, and we measure it in hertz, or cycles per second. Another way that we characterize sound is by the intensity. That's the loudness. So different frequencies, or a particular frequency, can be real loud. That means that the amplitude, right, from zero to the maximum, that distance is increased. That's what we call the amplitude. So these things are independent of each other. And maybe in lab you've measured your hearing, and it's measured in a unit we call decibels. And as the decibels increases, the sound gets louder. So that's the way that we talk about hearing. All right, so what do you need to hear something? You need your external ear. You need your middle ear. Right? You need vibration of the tympanic membrane. That vibration is transmitted through the middle ear into the stapes, and then the stapes pushes on this oval window, which then introduces that sound wave into the cochlea, this thing that kind of looks like a snail. All right, so what do I know about this snail right here, this cochlea? Okay. Well, it's like a piano, and if you have a piano, if you hit some keys on one side of the piano, you have high frequencies. If you hit the other end, what do you have? Low frequencies. And if you look inside the piano, why is that? Because the low frequencies are reproduced by what kinds of mechanical things? Strings that are what? Really thick and long. And the high frequencies are reproduced by strings. But are they the same size and shape as on the other side? No, they're going to be really thin and short. All right, so depending on the shape of the strings, they will have a tendency to vibrate at different frequencies, right? So the shape of a structure will determine what frequency it vibrates at. So the smaller the structure is, the higher the frequency it will vibrate at. The larger it is, the thicker it is, the lower the frequency it will vibrate at. And that's exactly how this cochlea is built. All right, so what could you do with this cochlea that's all wound up? You can unroll it, right? Like maybe you had a napkin that was all rolled up. You can unroll it. So now it becomes what? Really long. But it's linear. And what has evolution done so that you don't have this cochlea sticking outside your head? You don't want these two pianos sticking outside your ears. Evolution has figured out a way to roll them up to fit inside that petrous region of your temporal bone so they don't get broken off. All right, and it just so happens that this inner part, let's go back one more slide, this inner part, we can't see it on this diagram, but if we were to look down from the top down like this, we would see that this region right here is really wide. All right, so that is the widest part. The thinnest part is down over here. All right, so what does that mean? This part right here, which we call the helicotremus, since it's the widest part, what frequency does it like to vibrate at? A low frequency, and since this is the thinnest part over here, it likes to vibrate at a higher frequency. All right, so let's go back to this slide. So here we have the oval window. It's going to introduce sound waves into what we call the scala vestibuli. Maybe you need to go back and look at some of your anatomy. So here's the scala vestibuli connected to the oval window, and there's perilymph right here, so the sound wave enters this canal, and depending on what the frequency of that sound is, it might excite or vibrate the large part of the cochlea, which is down here by the end. We call that the helicotrema, or maybe the thin part, which is down by the oval window. And as that sound wave moves across down into the scala tympani, it's going to vibrate this organ that's responsible for hearing. And this is what we call the organ of Corti that is suspended in endolymph, right? So here is the organ of Corti, and there's a little fluid in here, that endolymph, that's what we call the cochlear duct. All right, so sound goes from the scala vestibuli into the cochlear duct and then through the organ of Corti into the perilymph. And so that energy that's inside your ear doesn't blow your ear up, it's got to be released. So here is another window right here that can vibrate back and forth, releasing that energy into this into the middle ear, and we call that the round window. All right, so that's nice. All right, so here is like a piano, right? You have things that respond to high frequencies on one end, low frequencies on the other, and what do we got in the middle right here? Things that respond to like mid-tones, intermediate kinds of frequencies. And these are all connected to nerves then that send action potentials to your temporal lobe. And in the temporal lobe, again, you have like two pianos, one in each temporal lobe. And when one part of the temporal lobe receives action potentials, you hear high frequencies, and then as it moves over more internally, you hear the other frequencies, right, just moving down. So let's take a look at this. So here's the scala vestibuli. What's connected to the scala vestibuli? Which window? That was the oval window right here. So sound enters, and let's just say that the proper sound now matches up to the shape of the organ of Corti, so it's going to move across the organ of Corti into the scala tympani and then out the round window. And as that energy moves, right, it's going to vibrate this tectorial membrane. And it just so happens that it has the right shape. And here you have the cochlear duct with endolymph in it. So now let's zoom into this region right here. And I think that's as high as we can get zoomed in. All right, so here's the tectorial membrane. It vibrates, but connected to it are some stereocilia or hairs that are connected to these receptor cells right here. And these are called hair cells, okay? And where else did you run into hair cells? In the crista ampullaris and the maculae, both the utricle and saccule, all right? And as this vibrates, that will then cause depolarization or hyperpolarization of this cell, and it will cause more or less neurotransmitter release, causing more or less graded potentials in this auditory nerve, which then will generate action potentials and send them to the auditory cortex, right, to the particular frequency in the temporal lobe, whether it's a high frequency or low frequency in the temporal lobe. Okay, so you should know that in the ear, you have these one kind of receptor cell for what? Three different modalities of energy. And it's interesting how evolution has changed it to give you a vastly different impression of those different modalities. Okay, so here you have the vestibular cochlear nerve entering the medulla, and there's a cochlear nucleus right here which sends it to the midbrain. The midbrain has the inferior colliculus. Maybe you can remember the corpora quadrigemina from anatomy. The superior one is involved with vision, but this inferior one is involved with hearing. And notice that it shares information from one side of the brain to the other. And so the job of the inferior colliculus is to enable you to localize sound. Right, so we have a number of doors in this building, And with your eyes closed, if somebody opened and closed the door, you could tell exactly which door it was. Because depending on what door is opening, sound will reach one ear before the other, and this inferior colliculus will compare the timing of those signals, and you'll get an impression of where that direction of where that sound is coming from. All right, then from the inferior colliculus to the thalamus, remember, sensory information has to stop in the thalamus, and then it's a job of the thalamus to direct those action potentials to the appropriate part of the cerebral cortex. And here you see the temporal lobe. Here is the primary auditory cortex. And in that auditory cortex, remember, it's laid out just like a piano. So if action potentials are received over here, you perceive a high frequency. If action potentials go way over here, then you perceive a low frequency. And if we were to artificially stimulate maybe this part, and this part of the temporal lobe, you would hear three different tones. And what do we typically call that when you hear three different tones put together? That would be like a chord, right? Okay, so think of the temporal lobe as being laid out just like a piano, just like you have in the cochlea. All right, so look over this table right here. I'll make sure that's in Blackboard. And we'll start right here and then move on to vision next time. But the sign-in sheet is going around someplace. Make sure you sign. I sent it around a little bit early today. Yeah, but I have a question. Probably a good question. Yeah. You know, I can't quite hear you. You might have to come on down. Yeah. Okay, I'll stop the recorder. So just make sure you sign the sign-in sheet.